Good evening, listeners. Welcome to Damn Radio. If you'd like to call in, please do. Call 573-746-8020 or email live at damradio.com. This is Jack's Car Show. I'm broadcasting live from the Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Art Studio. This is Damn Radio. So there's not really going to be a main focus of the show tonight. I missed the last few shows. Some of them I was planning to be gone. I had like a birthday and then I had a family reunion. And then Monday the 2nd, I just got really busy, but I'm back now and I should be for a little while. But usually I put together a show where I talk about the rise or fall of some brand or model or some event or something. But this one I've just kind of pieced together over the last couple of weeks whenever I get a minute. Over the years, I've just kind of accumulated a mixture of random trivia that I try and fit in wherever I can on this show. But sometimes it's just too off topic or it's just one anecdote. It's not really worth doing a show on, that kind of thing. Well, this is just a collection of random car fun facts and anecdotes, and I'll probably go off on some tangents. It's just stuff that I thought would be interesting enough to kind of compile into a show. But first, I want to get into the news segment. Some parts of this news segment are newer than others. Again, I pieced the show over the last couple of weeks. So the big news this week is the new Corvette ZR1X, which is the ZR1 but X. It's a ZR1, and it has the ZR1 has 1,064 horsepower, but this one, they add the front axle and the hybrid motor from the E-Ray. And the E-Ray has been forgotten about by everybody. I mean, we're going to look back on the E-Ray like we look back at the C6 Grand Sport, which is to say we don't look back on the C6 Grand Sport. Honestly, the E-Ray is probably pretty underrated. It's just nobody's ever bothered to check. But in any case, Chevrolet is going to add all that hybrid stuff to the ZR1. And so they're saying the ZR1X is going to make 1,250 horsepower, which is absurd. Honestly, I don't know why the car needs to exist, but I'll be honest, I do kind of like the idea of just crashing regular ZR1 values before the car even comes out. Because it always drove me nuts about C7 ZR1s. Probably still true. I haven't even looked lately, but they were selling for double what they cost new. I bet they still are. People just mark them up like crazy because, oh, this is the last front engine, this is the most powerful Corvette ever made. And so I figured it's probably true of the new ZR1. And so if something comes out even better than that, I think that's great. But in any case, I feel like the ZR1X is probably the one to buy. Obviously, it's the fast one. It's the one to buy, but it's all-wheel drive. And because to me, a mid-engine 1,000-horsepower car, it's probably pretty difficult to keep in a straight line, honestly. But I mean, even more so because the regular ZR1 is rear-wheel drive. Like, I can't imagine. That's going to be this generation's 930 Turbo or Viper in terms of just how many people crash them. I bet you in 20 years, every ZR1 you see is going to have a salvage title or, like, 2 miles on it. There's going to be nothing in between. But the ZR1X, okay, it's going to be more power, but it's all-wheel drive. So to me, that just makes it easier to drive, without immediately destroying it. They haven't announced pricing. Figure 200-plus, car will do 0-60 in less than 2 seconds. It'll run 9s in the quarter mile. Top speed will be well north of 200. It's crazy to me that this is how far the Corvette has come, that I'm not really all that excited by this. I'm not blown away anymore. It's like, yeah, of course it's 1,200 horsepower stock, whatever. Anyway, moving on, a couple of weeks ago, Acura, they announced they were going to sunset some of the subscription-based features on some of the older cars. And that, to me, is the real downside of automotive features being based on a subscription model, because everybody has problems with this idea, but most people think of like the BMW approach, which, BMW, you have to make a monthly payment to have heated seats. And I don't even think that's hyperbole. That's annoying. That's not really what Acura's thing is. You pay a subscription to get access to an app, basically. You can use your phone as a key, that kind of thing. It's not like there's hardware within the car that you have to pay to use. And so, if Acura wants to charge for server space, that's fine. The car works fine without the app. You don't really miss out on that much without it. The problem is you pull the plug on that functionality, and you kind of just leave people out to dry. I mean, that's annoying. And in some of the cars that they're discontinuing this service for, they're not that old. I mean, some of them, yeah, are 2014s, but 2022 is the newest model year in the list of cars they're shutting this down for. And one of those models is the 2017 to 2022 NSX. Like, how? It's a $200,000 car. If this was Acura in the old days and they were selling a $200,000 car, they'd have hired a full-time employee to sit at a desk whose only job it was to answer the phone when one specific NSX owner occasionally called in for service or whatever. They have one for every NSX owner. That is the way it should be when it's a $200,000 car. But these days, no. It's like your car's 3 years old. Sorry, you have less functionality than somebody who spent $35,000 on an 80X. That's probably why the new NSX didn't sell. It's a great car, but it's like Acura developed it, and then they just spent years pretending like it didn't exist. I guess you could say that's true of the original NSX, to be fair, but still. And the next news story. So last couple of years, the whole fast wagon thing has really taken off. And this story isn't that new. It's just I think it's worth talking about. I first heard this a couple of weeks ago. BMW just recently announced that the new M5 wagon is outselling the sedan. Which, I mean, you know, car enthusiasts are into wagons now. That's great. And that makes perfect sense on that car specifically because, well, to me, the wagon is the only way that the new M5 looks good. I think the sedan is hideous. The wagon looks all right. So the wagon's outselling the sedan. I find that interesting for a couple of reasons. The main thing is, okay, car enthusiast tastes have really shifted recently, so there's that. There started being a big push toward wagons in the enthusiast community. It probably started about 10 years ago. Really, in the last couple of years, it's picked up. It's nice to see that coming good. The other thing in my mind is values. That's probably the main thing, to be honest. Because think about the E61 BMW M5 Touring. That's the late 2000s M5, the wagon version. They never sold it here, but in markets where it was sold, they go for like triple what the sedan would. And it's the same story with the S211 E-Class and AMG, E-Class AMG wagons. They did sell those here. I mean, sell is a strong word, but I mean, nowadays you look at an E55 or an E63 sedan from that era, they go for 10 to 15, maybe a little more, maybe a little less, depending on whatever. But the wagons, if you can find them, they're in the 30s and 40s for like pretty clean examples. And I see pretty clean. The most recent E55 wagon to sell and bring a trailer, it had a couple of miners on the Carfax and it had 122,000 miles. This thing was not a museum piece and it sold for $48,000. If that was a sedan, it'd be worth like $8,000. It's ridiculous. And to be clear, I don't think that value difference is based on capability. I think wagons, they're definitely more capable than a sedan. But it's like if you have that money, you probably have something to carry stuff around with. You don't need to, I mean, how much stuff do you carry around in your 500 horsepower car that you have to have the wagon? Sedans are fine 99% of the time. And like we're not talking about a Lotus or nothing. Like the four-door is plenty practical. Now, the value difference comes from the rarity. Because only about 5% of those E55s sold in the United States were wagons. And so that's a couple hundred cars total. You know, people want what they can't have, so they're expensive. People want the wagons because they're rare. And I get that. That's part of what I like about them, too. I think at this point, people are just buying the wagons so that they depreciate slower. But when they make up more than half of M5 sales, I mean, what's going to happen here in the future? I actually kind of think the market's going to swing the other way. Because I think in 20 years, the sedans are going to be more collectible just because there's fewer of them. And all the people who kind of jumped on the wagon bandwagon because of all the practicality benefits, they're going to be flocking to the sedans because they're going to be talking about driver engagement and lower center of gravity and all that crap. I think kind of liking wagons is going to fade away from the mainstream like it did last time 50 years ago. But anyway, I'm going to move on to motorcycles just for a second. Honda finally fixed the only problem I had with the Transalp. The Transalp came out in the U.S. 2 years ago, and it's a little 750cc. It's like $10,000, I think. It's not even 10. It's like 999 something. But it's an adventure bike, and it's cool. And I always kind of wanted one. And I think they're great bikes, but they had a major problem, at least to me. Because I had known about these bikes before they came out here in the U.S. because they sold it in Europe for a couple of years. And I knew they came over there, they were sold in red, white, and blue with gold wheels. For the U.S., for the first 2 years, it was only sold in matte black, and I hated it. And I still think it looks stupid. I said, as soon as they bring the red, white, and blue one here to the States, I'm going to get one. And now they have. They finally have. And it looks great, but I'm not going to get one for a couple of reasons. Because I was excited when it came out, and I figured they would just do a red, white, and blue one. But I've matured. There's a couple of reasons. First one's a big one. Obviously, I'm not in any position to throw $10,000 into the air to get a bike that isn't as nice as the one I have. But putting that aside, the next real reason, it doesn't have cruise control. And I bet you $1 million that the Transalp is never going to have cruise control because Honda still wants a reason to sell the Africa. Like people, the Africa Twin exists and they want people to have a reason to buy it. And so they're not going to give the Transalp the cruise control because they want people to spend $5,000 to $8,000 more on an Africa Twin. But it's like, it's supposed to be an adventure touring bike. I don't want to do any kind of long distance without cruise control. It's supposed to be a touring bike. I mean, once you had cruise, you're never going to want a bike without it. The other reason is that I have matured. The reason I don't want it is that I've matured, and I've come to realize something. The Transal is what you get when you're too poor to afford the Africa Twin, or you're just too scared of a big, heavy bike to get an Africa Twin. And that first part isn't really true anymore because Africa Twins are finally depreciating. I have a buddy who just sold his Africa Twin for like $9,000. It was nine something. I can't remember. 9250, 9500, but it was somewhere in there. He sold it to a dealer. You know, so it's like they lowballed him, but still, it doesn't change the fact that he was happy to take that. And there are plenty of people who just want to dump him for not very much money. So if you're buying a new Africa Twin, there's something wrong with you. Just get a good used one for half off. And I mean, his was not like just a base model 2017 1000 with a bunch of miles. He had a 2020 Adventure Sport, had the dual clutch, red, white, and blue, gold wheels. His was a great spec. It was the Adventure. I mean, it's the fully loaded one, active suspension. And he sold it for like nine something. And it was like, yeah, okay, it's a couple years old. I think it was a 2020. But honestly, I mean, even from a looks perspective, like I think they kind of ruined the looks the last two or three years. I wouldn't want a new one anyway. So if you get that for the same price as a Transal, why would you ever get a Transal? And okay, yeah, it's like new versus used. Obviously, used is going to be cheaper. But it's like, when the Transal came out, the NT1100 wasn't sold here either. And that just came out recently. And I talked about this a couple months ago at this point. I love the NT1100. It's like, it's 11 something. It's a full touring bike. It's basically an Africa Twin underneath. It's got loads of power. It's got to be very comfortable, loads of wind protection. And they're like 11 something. If I had $12,000 and a reason to buy an NT1100, I would buy one. I don't have those things, but like if I did, I would want one. Like I would look for a reason to buy an NT1100. I think they're great. I don't want a Transalp anymore. I just think there's better options. But moving on. This is probably going to be the rest of the show. There's not really going to be any real flow to speak of. This will probably just be all over the place, but it's just a compilation of random fun facts and anecdotes and trivia that I've collected. And I tried to come up with as many as possible over the last few weeks to actually put together enough for a show. I think I have that. And don't expect any kind of organization here. I'm going to be talking about Ferrari 1 minute to, you know, Toyota Sienna's the next. So here we go. No particular order. Most people are familiar with the term facelift when it comes to cars. Like a manufacturer comes out with a new car, they sell it for 3 or 4 years, and then they change the headlights or grill, or they put on different mirrors, whatever. They update the styling, and they make it look a little newer, and they sell it for another 4 years before they come out with the actual replacement model. It's a facelift. But BMW doesn't use the term facelift. To BMW, it's an LCI, which they say stands for life cycle impulse. Whatever that means. It's not a facelift. It's a life cycle impulse. Whatever. So Ford Explorer came out in 1991. But there was a lesser known Mazda version. It was called the Navajo, the Mazda Navajo. And this is at a time when Ford owned a large stake in Mazda and they partnered up on a few cars. So you had the Ford Ranger / Mazda B Series. You had the Ford Probe / Mazda MX-3 and probably a couple others. This is just another one of those collaborations. So Mazda got a version of the Ford Explorer, but Ford wasn't going to let them have the good versions. You know, the Mazda Navajo was a base model, two-door. It was two-door only because Ford thought that if they had a four-door, that would cut into Explorer sales. But still, in any case, Motor Trend awarded the Navajo Truck of the Year even over the Explorer. So I guess they got that laugh. Obviously, the Navajo didn't sell anything like as big a number as the Explorer, but whatever. The main thing I want to talk about is the name. Guess why it was called the Navajo? They say it was because it was uniquely American and whatever. The real reason is it was supposed to compete with the Jeep Cherokee. That's it. But the problem is that the actual Navajo tribe took issue with the name. Jeep had run into that issue too, but their strategy had just been to simply ignore the problem. I mean, hell, they sold a truck in the 80s called the Comanche Eliminator. Like, they didn't care. But the Mazda didn't want to get in any trouble. You know, they're Japanese. That's how it goes. And so in order to avoid any further issues, as a show of good faith, Mazda gave the Navajo tribe a Mazda Navajo. A Mazda, like a car, a Mazda Navajo. They gave them one car. They gave the entire tribe one car. I guess they were supposed to like split it or make a schedule or over who got to drive it. I don't really know. I don't get it, to be honest, but that's what they decided to do. Anyway, moving on. The Toyota Sienna. So Toyota came out with the Sienna minivan for 1998, and it was widely agreed to be among the very best minivans available. It was a great car. It was the Camry of minivans. But, you know, as it goes, a couple of years passed, and Toyota's getting ready to start making a new Sienna. And so the chief engineer put in charge of the project was a guy named Yuji Yokoya. And he basically wanted to do all the research and development himself. Yokoya had no idea what buyers for this van wanted, because the Japanese car market is vastly different from the U.S. one. But they knew probably 90% of these vans are going to end up in the U.S. So you got to figure out what you're going to do here. In the last show I did about Geo, I talked about the Toyota way. It's 14 principles of Toyota's method for running a business. Well, number 12 on that list was go and see for yourself to thoroughly understand the situation. So Yokoya got in the old car, the first-gen Sienna, and he personally drove all around North America, all the lower 48 plus Alaska, every state in Mexico, every Canadian province. He personally did 53,000 miles of R&D by himself. I mean, well, maybe his family, but he personally did it. This is from the Chicago Sun-Times back in early 2003 about this story. So crossing the Mississippi River by bridge, he noticed that the Sienna's crosswind stability needed improvement. He observed excessive steering drift while traversing gravel roads in Alaska and the need for a tighter turning radius along the crowded streets in Santa Fe. Driving through Glacier National Park, he decided that the handling needed to be crisper. He also made an all-wheel drive option a priority, along with more interior space and cargo flexibility. So there you go. In 2004, the second generation Sienna came out and all those problems were addressed. And that's why people like Toyota, because they put in the effort to figure out what needs to be done. Although I don't know if it's much of a chore. Like if somebody told me that I could take months to just go drive all around North America and get paid for it and all my expenses are paid, I'd probably be all over it, to be honest. But it's still cool that that was how they developed that car. Anyway, moving on. McLaren Mercedes SLR. So Mercedes's flagship supercar from the early 2000s. It had a V8 mounted in the middle of the car, technically. It was front mid-engined. And that's kind of a thing now, more commonly. Like, the engine sits behind the front axle, so it's technically a mid-engine car, but it's still ahead of the cabin. That wasn't all that common in those days. It's more common now, but at the time, they had some kinks to work out. Servicing was kind of a challenge. And for the first couple of years that the SLR was on sale, mind you, this car cost like $500,000 in early 2000s money. For the first couple of years this car was around, officially, changing the spark plugs required you to drop the engine out of the car. And eventually somebody figured out a way to do it with the engine in the car, but I mean, yeah, spark plugs were engine out. Not that you'd go through that many spark plugs. I mean, not that many people drive these cars all that much, but still. Anyway, so moving on. 1981, the James Bond film For Your Eyes Only comes out, and there's a car chase scene where Roger Moore drives a Citroen TCV. And so in order to commemorate that, to coincide with the release of the film and kind of cash in on the whole James Bond thing, Citroen announced they were going to build 500 007 edition TCVs. And to be clear, this is one of the dumbest looking special editions I've ever seen. It's yellow, like the one in the movie. But it has giant, like, 2 foot tall 007 decals down the side. Like it just says 007 on the side of a yellow TCV. It's heinous. The cool part is they put decals of bullet holes all the way around the car. And given that James Bond is very popular in the UK for obvious reasons, Citroen of UK was very interested in getting allocations for some of the 007 edition cars. And so Citroen UK tasked a guy in the marketing department. He claimed to speak French. And he was supposed to send a letter to Citroen's headquarters requesting some of the cars. The problem is the French phrase for bullet holes is trou de balle, or however you say this. I have it. There you go.
Trou de balle.
Yeah, it's that. Technically, that's correct. That's bullet holes. The problem is, in French slang, trou de balle isn't usually taken literally. And so it's said that the fine people at Citroen's headquarters got a letter in the mail asking them about their new special edition, quote, covered in stickers of arse holes. And I think that's wonderful. All right, moving on. Formula One. So Formula One team Tyrrell, they don't exist anymore. They were the guys who made that famous six-wheeled F1 car in the 70s. I mean, these guys are creative. And they got extra creative when it came to kind of getting around F1 rules and regulations in 1984. So early 80s, turbochargers became extremely common in Formula One. You know, turbos let you make a whole lot of power with very little downside. But the problem is the owner of Tyrrell, you know, Ken Tyrrell, he didn't like the whole turbocharger thing. He felt it wasn't in the spirit of the sport, which is surprising. I mean, you'll see what I mean. Anyway, without turbocharged engines, the Tyrrell cars were kind of at a disadvantage. They made less power than everybody else, and so the team started looking at how to save weight. The problem is, in F1, there was a minimum weight restriction, so there's a floor on how little your car would be allowed to weigh and compete. But the Tyrrell team realized, you know, the weight technically included all the fluids, and the car was to be weighed before the race and then after the race also, but before the second weigh-in, the teams were allowed to refill all the fluids, and so Tyrrell just added a giant water tank to just add a bunch of weight, and they claimed it was to, quote, aid brake cooling. And so the idea was, as soon as they got out on the track, they just dump all the water out, and they have a way lighter car than everybody else, and nobody noticed because technically they were allowed to refill the water tank because it is a fluid before they reweigh the car. But the F1 guys caught on to that pretty quick, and they shut it down. They claimed it was cheating. I would argue it wasn't cheating, but, you know. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and take a quick break. You're listening to Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio.
Change everything you are and everything you surely come.
The 2012 version of Need for Speed Most Wanted was a great game. It was one of my favorites, and I just replayed it recently, and that song was like the opening theme, and I forgot how great it was, so I wanted to play it. But anyway, back from the break, 573-746-8020, live at damradio.com. So I've talked on this show before about how the original Acura Legend was co-developed with Rover, who sold their own kind of reworked version, the Rover 800 series. And so Honda and Rover had something of a partnership going on in the 70s and 80s, or 80s and 90s. And that extended to probably the most bizarre rebadge in history, because Honda famously kind of went kicking and screaming into the whole SUV thing. They didn't do SUVs for a while. And then when they did, we got stuff like the Honda Passport, which is just a rebadged Isuzu Rodeo, and the original Acura SLX, which is just an Isuzu Trooper. But in Honda's home market of Japan, they sold another, the Honda Crossroad. And it was just a Land Rover Discovery, and it had Honda badges on it. Like, that was it. It was a Land Rover, but Honda. It didn't sell well because it was a Land Rover, and they had tons of issues. But still, I mean, it lasted for a couple of years, 93 to 98, so whatever that is, six model years. And it was the only time that Honda ever sold a car with a V8. And perhaps, there's an even less well-known version than that. There was the second generation Crossroad. Like, the Crossroad name wasn't retired. Like, they came out with another one in 2007. And it was a pretty cool little car. They talked about selling it here. It was like a compact kind of boxy thing. It was a little bitty car, but it had three rows. And they talked about selling it here, but we already got the Element, and that was doing really well, so they didn't bother. But anyway, moving on. Another rebadge. Quite a few people know about the Saab 92X. That's the Saabaru. It's the Saab. It's a rebadged Subaru WRX, but it's a Saab, okay? And I've talked about it a few times on here, and it existed because for a time, General Motors owned a large stake in Subaru. Well, there was a lesser-known product of that relationship, the Chevrolet Forester. In the early 2000s, General Motors was really trying to expand the Chevrolet brand in other markets, because Chevy, for the most part, is just an American thing. But there was a time when they were just slapping the Chevy badge on every car they think of, you know, just send it around the world. And so in India, they took a Subaru Forester and they changed the badges to Chevrolet. That was it. They didn't even change the model name. It was just a Chevrolet Forester, and it existed in India. Moving on. A lot of people know that the Pagani Zonda had a 7.3 liter V12, and it was built by Mercedes AMG. And they also put that engine in the R129 SL, the SL73 AMG. They made about 85 of them. But even more crazy than that, fewer people know this. At the height of the Sultan of Brunei's crazy car buying spree in the 90s, he ordered 18 S-Classes with that engine. And not just that, they were even crazier because those S-Classes were modified to be wagons. And half of them, about half, had the front clip off an S-Class coupe. So this is a 90s S-Class wagon with a coupe front end and a 525 horsepower supercar engine. And Mercedes themselves built, not one, not two, but 18 of these things, just because a really rich guy asked them to, and I think that's wonderful. And in that same vein, Princess Diana had a Ford Escort RS Turbo. Because before that, she'd had a couple of Ford Escorts, including a red convertible. That was like the most famous one. But she's a princess, and so her security detail wasn't too thrilled about such a, you know, a car that sticks out way too much. So they got into contact with Ford. And at the time, Ford was coming out with the Series 1 Escort RS Turbo. And that was a sporty racing homologation version of the Escort. And Diana wanted that. The thing is, it was only available in white. But, you know, the thing is, the security guy still thought a white car with blue stripes is a little ostentatious. And so Ford agreed to build three factory black RS turbos specifically for Diana and her bodyguards. But like, think about that. Those are the only black ones. All the other ones are white. So if you're just driving around in England in the 80s and you see a black RS turbo, then you just know it's Diana or she's close by. I don't really see how that solved the problem they had. And it's the same story with Steve Jobs' car. This one's probably more well-known, but in the state of California, there is, or at least there was, a law that stated you have 6 months from the time of purchase of a new car to attach a license plate. Well, Steve Jobs, I guess, decided he didn't want anybody to know his plate number or, you know, to follow him or whatever. So he simply ran without plates, and he did it legally. Because he'd quote-unquote lease a new Mercedes SL55 every 180 days or so. And there's a misconception about this. It wasn't that he got a different identical car every 6 months. It was always the same car, but the leasing company just kind of messed with the paperwork, just like came up with a new lease every 180 days or so. He's a new lessee every 180 days. So when the six-month grace period ran up, look at that. He just leased this car, apparently. So he's good. Legally, he was never required to display any plates. Which is weird, because then all the paparazzi and whoever could just look for the SL55 that doesn't have any plates, but whatever. And Jobs was even, you know, asked about that point by a guy named Walter Isaacson, who wrote a book about him. This is an interview with Steve Jobs. Okay, so Isaacson asked, "Why don't you have a license plate?" Jobs replied, "I don't want people following me." "Well, not having a license plate is probably more noticeable." "Yeah, you're probably right. You know why I don't have a license plate?" "Why?" "Because I don't have a license plate." And then he would just proceed to park in handicapped spots everywhere, because, I mean, whatever, I don't know why. He's rich. I mean, you have that much money, I guess you don't care about tickets, and that's fine. Like, if you want to avoid paying to register a car, I mean, hell yeah, that's, you know, that's cool. But, like, if you're just going to go get tickets anyway, I really don't get the point. But anyway, moving on to a section of the show that I guess I'll call surprising manual transmission options, because there's a couple of these I have here. The Aston Martin DB9, it was originally offered with a manual transmission. Of the 16,500 DB9s they made, it's widely agreed that only about 5% were sticks, meaning they only made about 800 manual DB9s. They do exist. I mean, they made them. Like, it's actually crazy they made them. And they go for good money, and Martha Stewart has one. Like, as far as I know, she bought it new, and just, I mean, think about it. Nobody really bought them that way. She probably custom ordered it, meaning Martha Stewart probably sat in an Aston Martin dealership 20 years ago and custom ordered a stick shift DB9. And I think that's great. Moving on. In the movie The Big Lebowski, and by the way, I've criticized the cars in that movie on here before, because it's supposed to be set in the early 90s, but they tried to present an 84, 85 Corvette as being a brand new car. But in that movie, you see Bunny Lebowski driving a Jaguar XJS, and then you'll see a close-up of her feet operate a manual transmission. And technically, that could have lined up, because 93 and 94, the Jaguar XJS was offered in the United States with a manual transmission. They were very, very rare. Only about 200 or so were sold. But the thing is, the car in the movie wasn't one of those cars, because the car in that movie was a 90 or 91. Because they facelifted the XJS for 92. The one in the movie is a pre-facelift, but it has an airbag, and that didn't come out till 90, so it's a 90 or 91. So it's definitely not a manual transmission car. They just did some funny editing, but I just thought you should know. Some more rare manual cars. One of my absolute dream cars. For only the first two model years, 93, 94, the original Jeep Grand Cherokee, the ZJ, was offered with a manual transmission. And it was very unpopular, so they canceled it. But of 1.5 million or so ZJs they built, only about 3,000 or so had manuals for the world. If I had all the money in the world, that's the first car I'm buying. I want a stick shift Grand Cherokee. And that's not to say they're that expensive, but like, money just comes with resources. I need to find one. Because most of them are just trash, like most ZJs. Also, R129 Mercedes SL, the SL from 90 to 2002. Initially, those were also offered in the United States with a manual transmission. Only about 400 or so made it to the States. It was only offered on the base model, the SL, or the 300 SL. It used a straight six, and nobody bought it because it's a big, luxurious Mercedes. Why would you want a manual transmission, especially a transmission that isn't that nice to use? I mean, Mercedes was never focused on making a nice manual transmission. They're not Porsche. You know, the transmission in that car is probably like fine for a Berlin taxi, but that's about it. But the last rare manual car that I'll talk about, everybody's obsessed with Ferrari 599s and then the manual versions of that. They're really rare. And like a regular automatic 599 is a $150,000 car. but a manual is like an 800 car. But there was an even rarer manual GT Ferrari at the time. It was the California. The California was offered with a stick. Initially, the car was only offered with a dual clutch automatic because that was the big thing with the California. It was the first Ferrari to have a dual clutch. It was a big deal for them. But for 2012, they thought, hey, you know, this is kind of our small, affordable car. Maybe the car people want a manual transmission. So they started offering one. And of the 600 Californias sold in 2012, two are manuals. As in two. They sold two manual Californias. So they canceled it for the next year. They sold two manual Californias. And that was the last time that Ferrari offered a manual transmission on any of their models. And nowadays, everybody's like, hey, why doesn't Ferrari offer manuals? They'd sell really well. You guys had your chance. Ferrari learned their lesson. They're not playing that game again. They developed a manual transmission for that car, and they sold two. Sorry. Moving on. Some people remember that in the 70s, there were Levi's edition Jeeps, and they had seats made from upholstery that kind of looked like Levi's blue jeans, like denim-style seats with blue jeans-style buttons on them. And it was cool. And it was, honestly, it was the only one of those partnerships that I can think of that ever had anything to do with the clothing brand it was based on. Like, you didn't get blue jean seats in a Nautica Edition Mercury Villager or an L.L. Bean Subaru. Well, as it turns out, the partnership wasn't between Levi's and Jeep. It was between Levi's and AMC, and like AMC as a whole. And so as a result, there was a Levi's Edition Gremlin. And it also had those blue jean-style seats, and I think that's great. And not so much a fun fact. Speaking of 70s Jeeps, they came with V8s in a lot of cases. It's not really that obscure of a fact. I just think it's worth bringing up because that's insane. And second, I mean, you remember how adamant Jeep was about not putting a V8 in the Wrangler until only a couple of years ago. I remember when they said they'd never do it and that it wouldn't be safe because there was only enough crumple zone for a V6 or something like that. And then a couple of years later, they came out with the Rubicon 392 and it did 0 to 60 in like 4 seconds and it cost $80,000+. And it was very cool. But the only performance figure that I ever cared about with that truck is the top speed, because a regular Rubicon is limited to 97 miles an hour. And that makes sense because it's a big, top-heavy, slab-sided vehicle, solid front axle, big knobby tires. The problem is all that's true of the regular Rubicon 392 also. So you spend like $100,000 on this crazy fast Wrangler, and it's electronically limited to 99 miles an hour. I don't really get the point. And I mean, you could remove the limiter, but like if you've ever driven a Wrangler fast, it's not really the best vehicle for going fast. Like 97 is plenty. I don't really want to go any faster, not in a Wrangler. So I guess it's more like, why does the Rubicon 392 need to exist? I don't get it, but moving on. C4 Corvette. Okay, C4 Corvette, it came out in 84, but it wasn't until 2 years later that you get the convertible version. But that first model year, 1986, every Corvette convertible technically was a pace car. Like officially, every 86 Corvette convertible was a pace car. They came with pace car graphics. Now, they weren't necessarily installed, but you got the stickers when you bought the car. Technically, they're pace cars. And honestly, I'm not really surprised about, I don't know. I guess I am surprised that not every single one has them on. Because it's like, think about guys with later C4s and C5 pace cars, and they act like they're these great collectible items. I don't want to go off on a rant. Like, I understand the C5 Corvette is a great car. I just think it's ugly, and you make a purple version with yellow wheels and seats, and it doesn't really make it look any better. I think the pace cars are kind of cool. But everybody thought they were collector's items. And anything that's designed from the outset to be collectible never is. Because just look at the C4 and C3 buyers. Because 96, last year, the C4, there was a Corvette collector's edition. And it was just like a silver over gray car. They said collector's edition on them. They're not valuable or collectible in any way now. And it's even worse with the C3 collector's edition. I have no idea why they made that. But I can tell you, when collectors are looking at C3 Corvettes, they're not looking at beige automatic only 82 Crossfire fuel injection cars. Like, there's no reason the 82 collector's edition needed to exist, but whatever. Main fun fact, the main reason I brought this up, all 86 Corvette convertibles are officially pace cars. And I'm going to stick with Corvettes for a second, because this isn't so much a fun fact as just thing that nobody remembers because it was stupid, but a couple of years ago, when NFTs were a big thing, Chevrolet decided they wanted in on that, and so they had plans to build a one-off bright green C8 Corvette Z06, and alongside it, they made some NFTs, you know, just... It's like a form of cryptocurrency. It's just an expensive picture. But they were going to go along with the car. And they started an auction that ran for 5 days. And because this is a crypto thing, They opened the bidding at 206 Ethereum. I don't know what the unit is, like coins, I don't know. It's crypto. But at the time, that was like $250,000. Well, it's like Corvette target demo is like boomers, and they don't buy crypto, and it's kind of a lot of money. So nobody bid, and the idea kind of died. And that's sad. But yeah, there was a Corvette, basically NFT edition. On a side note, honestly, you put aside the NFT thing, the idea of a one-off color is kind of cool. Because painted sample Porsches go for stupid money. Like Chevrolet will charge you $10,000 if you want a custom VIN. Why not just, you know, steal Porsche's idea and charge another 10 to 20 grand for a custom color? I'm surprised they haven't done that. They'd be printing money. But moving on. You know the stereo brand Macintosh? They make some fairly nice stuff, and it's been well publicized that they make the stereo in some newer Jeeps, and one of the four options in the 2005 and 6 Ford GT was a Macintosh stereo. Whenever it's talked about, and Macintosh rarely acknowledges this, is that the third and fourth generation Subaru Legacy and by extension Outback were available with factory Macintosh stereos. It is barely a Macintosh. It was designed and built by Clarion, and it sounded fine. It wasn't really anything special. Macintosh had very little to do with it. It was just a branding exercise, but I find that interesting. You can get a car with a Macintosh stereo cheaper than you can get a Macintosh stereo. And speaking of that era of Subaru, remember I said GM had a decent stake in Subaru at the time. And so that's why for a couple of years, some of the higher trim Subaru vehicles were available with GM's OnStar, back when people cared about that kind of thing. And the Subaru partnership makes sense because of that relationship. But the thing is, OnStar also found its way into some other unrelated brands like 02 to 06, Acura offered OnStar. 03 to 06, Volkswagen offered OnStar. But after 2006, OnStar kind of quit working that way because around that time, pretty much all telecommunications companies, cell phone companies, OnStar, they made the switch from analog to digital signals. And so GM changed the hardware required for OnStar to work. And I guess in the mess of all that, they lost those contracts. But yeah, there was a time in the early 2000s you could have gotten an Acura with OnStar. Renault. Let's talk about Renault. So Renault in the 80s was a wild place to be because up until 1996, 80% of Renault was owned by the French government. And so the company really started having serious problems in the late 70s and early 80s. And so the French government brought in a man with a reputation for fixing big companies, a guy named George Bess. And there was a reason he was so good at turning companies around. He was just an expert cost cutter. Well, when you run an automaker, what's your biggest cost? The workforce. And so he took over in 1985, and he immediately laid off 21,000 workers. And keep in mind, this is France. The French get very angry about this sort of thing. Usually the French would prefer the entire company just go down in flames and for anybody to individually lose their job. And you add in the fact that he's trying to invest a lot of the company's resources into them, a foreign car company, AMC. He wasn't all that popular over there. And so 8:25 p.m., evening of November 17, 1986, Bess was dropped off in front of his house by his chauffeur when he was approached by two women pushing a baby stroller. The women reached into the stroller and they pulled out guns. They shot him 6 times in the head and chest and left. And then the story varies. Some reports say they ran away on foot. Some say they ran over to two men on parked motorcycles and they simply rode away. It's hard to know. There's not really all that much info about this in English. But a couple of months passed, then the Marxist-Leninist terrorist group, Action Directe, however you say it's French, Direct Action, took credit. And so arrests were made. A couple of people went to prison for a long time. It was a whole thing. But that's probably the only time, at least that I can think of, that the president of an automaker left his position on account of being assassinated. And then I want to say it was a year or two after that that Renault pretty much cut ties with AMC. So AMC was sold to Chrysler. AMC might still be around if not for that happening, if not for that guy getting assassinated. But anyway, I'm going to go ahead and take another quick break. I'll be right back. You're listening to Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio.
Now I live.
appropriate song to play after talking about a guy who got assassinated for laying off a bunch of workers. But anyway, moving on. So back in the 90s, Volkswagen offered Bon Jovi, Pink Floyd, and Rolling Stones editions of the Mark III Golf. There was also a Genesis edition Polo. And they were weird and pointless, and there was no real tie-in with the artists that they were supposed to be. But, well, there was an equally weird and pointless partnership a couple of years later with First Act Guitars. And this is a marketing stunt. It lasted only for a few months in 2006, but VW hired John Mayer, Slash, and Nigel from Spinal Tap to appear in ads playing these custom First Act guitars. And if you bought, you could pretty much buy any VW you wanted, Golf, Beetle, Jetta, whatever, anything except for the Touareg. If you bought one, you got a free guitar to go along with it. And the guitars also had a VIN plate that matched whatever car you bought. And the guitars are pretty cool themselves. There's VW emblems all over it. The dials are VW badges. Neck strap is made out of a seatbelt. Kind of cool looking guitars. And normally, you need an actual amplifier to run an electric guitar because the guitar itself doesn't actually supply any signal. There's no power coming out of the guitar. Unlike with a smartphone, you know, the guitar is just an instrument. It just kind of changes whatever signal it gets. But this guitar had a built-in preamp. It was powered by a 9-volt battery, and it made it so you could use the stereo in your car as an amplifier if you wanted to. That was how they pitched it. You just plug the guitar into the aux jack. And you can find those First Act guitars on eBay. And honestly, I've been tempted by them. Like, I don't play guitar. I'm not interested in playing guitar, but those things go for like $200. That'd be a pretty cool decoration for a house. You just hang that on the wall. Because on one hand, it's a cool-looking guitar, so like the casuals come in and they think it's cool. They understand why you have it. But also, the car people, like, this is a, you know, bizarre, esoteric 2000s VW thing. It never needed to exist. Car enthusiasts love that kind of thing. And anyway, speaking of stuff that came with cars, when you bought a McLaren F1, you got a watch. And it was a Tag Heuer. And like every 90s Tag Heuer, it wasn't really all that attractive, but they're still cool for obvious reasons. You know, you wear the watch and everybody knows you drive a McLaren F1 as if you didn't already tell them. I mean, that's really about as cool as it gets. So I look for those watches every now and again. And I've never actually found one, of course, because they made about 100 F1s and therefore probably 100 watches. So not too many are going to be floating around. But if one by itself transacts, I'm sure it'll go for stupid money because, again, McLaren F1. What I think it would be able to afford is a Mercury Marauder leather jacket. In 2003, 2004, the Marauder was out. It was definitely the coolest Panther platform car. Really, honestly, really cool car. It didn't sell well, but if you were to purchase one, you got a custom leather jacket. I mean, custom to the Marauder, not to you. I don't actually know who made the jacket, but the tag just says made exclusively for Mercury Marauder owners. And it's a pretty unimpressive jacket. It's probably the most boring looking leather jacket I've ever seen. It's nothing special, but it goes to a Mercury Marauder, and I think that's awesome. I'd love a Marauder leather jacket. Ferrari F50. It was famously sold with a pair of racing shoes because when Ferrari came out with the F50, they wanted to play it up as like an F1 car for the road. So you got a pair of racing shoes to go with it. And also the F50 came from the factory with a build book. It was basically a photo album with pictures of your F50 as it moved down the assembly line. You got to see every step of it being built, which is kind of neat. And I mean, I gotta wonder, knowing Ferrari, whenever somebody crashed one, they probably just made a new one with the same VIN and then pretended like nothing happened. They did that with the Enzo, maybe they did it with the F50, I don't know. But if they did, would you have gotten the new book for the new car? I wonder that. And people say the F50 also came with a watch. That wasn't exactly true. There was a Gerard Perregaux watch made specifically for the F50 and F50 owners, but it didn't come with the car. You had to buy it. But you could only buy it if you had an F50. You had to prove that you had one. Like, but F50 exclusive watch. The watch probably costs tens of thousands of dollars, but these are F50 owners. Like, they're used to wasting money on stupid things. Case in point, they bought an F50. Let's talk about Mercedes AMG. Because people nowadays are crapping all over Mercedes for just slapping AMG badges on lesser cars. Like, you'll have the 63 version of whatever car, like E63, and it's the full-fat twin-turbo V8 million horsepower cool version. And then below that, you got the E53, which is an immensely powerful turbo six-cylinder. And then there's the E43, which is the less powerful version of that. So everybody's like, why would you make a deliberately lame version? You know, why make the E43? I'll happily admit, it's clearly just a cash grab aimed at people who want to feel like they bought the fast one. And nowadays, even like the C63 isn't even a V8 anymore. It's just a little four-cylinder. And granted, the four-cylinder makes like 700 horsepower, but still, people feel like AMG is kind of being watered down. My contention is AMG's been watered down as long as AMG's been around. Because, like, the lesser AMG model criticism, that's been a thing forever. In the early 2000s, that's like the golden era of Mercedes in my mind. Well, there was the S55, which is a supercharged V8, and then above that, there's the S65, which is a turbocharged V12. So it's like there's a better and lesser one. I guess you could argue the lesser car still made like 500 horsepower. Fine. On the other hand, like, listen, in the United States, we got the C32 AMG, very fast car, about 350 horsepower from a supercharged V6. It's not crazy now, but that was a lot back in the early 2000s. But if you want to talk about lesser AMGs, in other markets, that same W203 C-Class was also available as the C30 CDI AMG. That was a 230 horsepower C-Class diesel AMG. And it made decent torque, and it wasn't that slow. 0 to 60 is like 7 seconds, but the previous generation C43, even probably C36, would have probably run circles around that thing. Let's not act like Mercedes offering slower, lesser AMGs is a new thing. The AMG brand has pretty much been watered down for its entire existence. It used to be AMG was just a tuning company. Like, if you had an S-Class and you wanted a little more power, or even if you just wanted like a nicer stereo or wider wheels, that was what AMG was for. People have this image in their mind of like the CLK 63 Black Series, and that's what AMG is to a lot of people. Keep in mind, AMG just used to customize regular Mercedes for regular people. And they also made a diesel C-Class in the early 2000s. Let's talk about trucks. So remember the GMT 900, like the late 2000s Tahoe and Escalade hybrids? They weren't the first hybrids from General Motors. They weren't even the first hybrid trucks from General Motors. There was a GMT 800 Silverado hybrid. It came out in 2004. And it was a joke, really. It wasn't a hybrid like a Prius. It was almost as if the hybrid batteries and motor were just like, it was all supposed to be a really big starter. The truck didn't have an alternator. Like, it had auto start stop. Again, this thing came out in 2004. That's every car sold now, but 20 years ago this thing existed. It had auto start stop with a 5.3 liter V8. And the auto start stop is probably the only reason why it had any kind of mileage advantage over a regular 5.3 Silverado. I say mileage advantage. It got 1 mile per gallon better, despite being a hybrid and probably costing thousands and thousands of dollars more. But if you want to start the Silverado hybrid, you know, you turn the key. It's almost the exact same noise as pulling away from a light in a car with auto start stop. Because it doesn't have a standard starter. It's just like you snap your fingers and the engine's on. Like, that's how this thing behaves. And the main virtue of this truck over the regular one really was that you could essentially treat it as just a big V8 power generator. You got 120 volt AC outlets everywhere. And that's, you know, honestly a big advantage to truck guys. Like, you're at a job site, you want to plug in power tools. It's pretty useful. And also, the year it came out, another layer of weirdness, 2004, it was only sold in Alaska for some reason. I don't know. Then the next year, a few other states, like 5, California, Florida, and then eventually it became available everywhere. They say they sold about 3 million or so Cat Eye Silverados, 03 to 07 Silverados, and of that 3 million, 3,000 were hybrids. It wasn't a big commercial success. And I'm going to stick with the GMT 800 trivia, because it's somewhat well known that the GMT 800 generation of Chevrolet SUVs sold in Mexico had Cat Eye Silverado front end, you know, headlights, grill. You know, the SUVs had that. What's less well known is that in Mexico, even though the facelifted SUVs got the Silverado front end, the Silverado didn't, at least not for that year. The next year it did, but I mean, for 2003 in the United States, Silverado got facelifted, the Suburban and Tahoe unchanged. 2003 in Mexico, like, the SUVs got a facelift that even the U.S. ones didn't get, but the pickup where those parts came from didn't get touched for another year. And speaking of Mexican market GMT 800s, in the U.S., there were a bunch of V8 options. There was a 5.3, 4.8, 6.0, 8.1. In Mexico, you could have gotten it with a 5.7. You could have gotten it with the old 350 if you'd wanted it. And that's without even going into the names. Because in Mexico, okay, the Suburban was just called the Suburban. But the Tahoe was called the Sonora. And it's probably because nobody there knows what Tahoe is. Fine. And the Silverado largely was called the Silverado, or is called the Silverado, except the higher trim ones. Because starting with the 2004 facelift, higher trim ones are the Cheyenne. And that makes no sense, because truthfully, even the Silverado name isn't that well established in the United States. Because, I mean, the Silverado wasn't even called the Silverado until the new body style came out in 99. Prior to that, it was just C or K, depending on whether it was two or four-wheel drive. And then, you know, 1500, 2500, whatever. Silverado was just the name of an old trim level, along with, as you might guess, Cheyenne. And GMC trucks had become Sierras a few years prior. And so it was decided that Chevrolet would kind of come up with a name for their trucks, do the same thing. So technically, the Silverado hasn't even been around that long, less than 30 years. And also, despite the trucks being identical for a million years in the past, the first generation Silverado is technically the second generation Sierra. But my point is, basic trims of the Silverado are the Silverado in Mexico. The higher trim ones are Cheyennes. And that's great. And Ford does the same thing, by the way, because starting with the 10th gen F-150 in 97, in Mexico, the base trucks are F-150s, but the nicer, higher trim ones are called Lobos. And Lobo is Spanish for wolf. And by the way, since I added this in here, Ford just announced that they're going to be bringing an F-150 Lobo to the U.S. And it's not the same thing. The U.S. one is just a trim. It's not a model. And it's kind of a special edition, like street truck version. But in Mexico, Lobo is just every F-150 higher than like Lariat, you know, just the nicer trim levels. And speaking of the 10th gen F-150, that was, you know, the round one, the first round one, the new body style. Everybody calls it the dick nose. It came out in 97, and there was something of a long transition when it came to Ford trucks. So the brand new half ton existed, right, for 97, but they didn't have the new Super Duties ready for another couple of years. So, you know, I'm talking about the 3/4 and 1 ton. So for 97, they sold the new F-150 and then the old square-shaped, you know, F-250 and 350. But they also offered a light-duty F-250, which is just an F-150 with stronger axles and suspension. You know, and then the old body-style F-250 became the F-250 HD. And then in 98, they discontinued all the heavy-duty ones. So for that year, 1998, Ford only offered the F-150 and then ostensibly an F-250, but it was just a slightly tougher F-150. And it was just a stopgap. And then 99, the actual Super Duties came out. And the F-250 light duty was forgotten about. But they didn't quit making it because it existed for the 99 model year. And then in 2000, it was absorbed into the F-150. It just became the F-150 7700 package as a reference to the total vehicle weight. And you can tell them apart by the 7-lug, you know, hubs. And whenever I see a 10th gen F-150 with F-250 badges, I get really excited because it was a real thing. It was an F-150, just tougher, and they sold it as an F-250. Anyway, moving on. Remember TVR? Most people who aren't from the UK haven't really heard much about TVR unless they spend a lot of time watching British car television programs. If you know about TVR, you probably know how they got the name. Trevor Wilkinson, he was the founder, and it was just named after him. Originally, the company was called TrevCar until I guess they decided that sounded stupid, so the company was just renamed to a shortened version of the name Trevor, TVR. That's not why I bring up TVR. And by the way, if you don't know, TVR just makes like little sports cars. The main TVR fun fact, in my estimation, is what happened when TVR used to go to car shows. Because, you know, there's big major auto shows, London, Geneva, etc., where automakers reveal their all new models. The problem TVR always had is they were a small company. They really had any money to develop any new models. And so, in order to attract attention to the TVR booth, they just hired some models to sit on the cars completely naked. And just hired some naked chicks to come sit on the cars all day to get people to look at or write about them. And as far as I know, it worked, at least back then. And I guess it worked so well that for a time, TVR had a partnership with Penthouse Magazine. As a result, there was the 1988 TVR Penthouse S. And as far as I know, it was a regular TVR S2, but it had a quote, wooden effect dash. But yeah, there's a TVR Penthouse edition. And in that same vein, the Playboy Playmate of the Year used to get a car every year. It's not that interesting, although I suspect it's an indicator of how well Playboy was selling in any given year, because some cars were better than others. The lady in 72 got a De Tomaso Pantera. The 98 lady got a Shelby Series 1. The 1969 lady got a GT500. There were a whole load of Porsche 928s and Jaguar XJSs. Then you get, like, other ones. The 1973 lady got a Volvo 1800 ES wagon. That's the kind of sporty coupe wagon thing. The 1988 lady got a Lamborghini Countach kit car, and not even a convincing one. And then obviously with the advent of the internet, Playboy's popularity just fell off a cliff. And so then you get into like 2007 lady got a Mini Cooper convertible. 2008 lady got a base model Cadillac CTS. 2009 lady got a Mazda 6. And in the past, they were all painted pink, and now they can't even be bothered to do that. Moving on, rental cars. If you're like me, and you think about rental cars the way I do, and how people probably treat them, you often sit around and you wonder what percentage of cars started out in life as rental cars. I will give you the only perspective you'll ever need on that. I don't know about you, but I see Chevrolet Captiva Sports every single day, constantly, all the time. And by the way, Captiva Sport, we never got the regular Captiva here in the States. We only got the Captiva Sport, and they're different. But the main thing is here in the United States, you couldn't just buy a Captiva Sport because GM only offered them to fleets, meaning probably 99% of them were sold to rental car agencies. So like sometimes I'll see five of them in a single day, but the fact is every single one started out in life in a rental fleet. And it was only offered for a couple of years, 2012 to 2015. That's four model years. And it's worth noting, a version of this car was sold normally to customers as the Saturn View a few years earlier. But even still, probably three quarters of these I see are the Chevrolet version. So I don't know about you, but I'm shocked that I see as many of these things as I do. Four model years, sold only to fleets. So it's like, just imagine how many other normal cars start out in life as rental cars. Because the Captiva Sport is basically the only car that you can definitively say at a glance began life as a rental car. So what percentage of Dodge Chargers and Nissan Altimas and Rogues and Mitsubishi Mirages and Ford Mustangs started out as rental cars? I guarantee you the number is probably way higher than you think it is. And speaking of rental cars, the original Chrysler Sebring, it wasn't a very good car, but some versions of it were way better than others. Now, I wouldn't even brought this up, but I saw a coupe version yesterday, and it reminded me of this. The first generation Chrysler Sebring coupe and convertible were completely different cars. They shared nothing. The convertible was based on the Dodge Stratus, which, you know, fine. It's an adequate midsize sedan. It's not really what you should base a sporty car on, you know, but the Sebring's a replacement for the LeBaron, so who really cares? But that's the convertible. The Sebring coupe was based on the Mitsubishi Eclipse, and not like the crappy third or fourth gen Eclipse. It's based on the Sebring coupe came out in 95. It's based on the second gen Eclipse, the cool Eclipse. And you can't really tell that, but I will say the original Sebring coupe isn't a bad-looking car. It's cool-looking enough that I noticed it and it attracted my attention enough to include it in here. And moving on, finally, in an Aston Martin, the key is really cool. You basically push the key into this little slot in the dash, and it goes in such a way that it looks like the key isn't even there. Nothing sticks out or looks stupid. There's just this glass circle in the middle of the dash, and that's awesome. The reason I bring this up, Aston Martin has a name for their keys. And Aston Martin, it's not simply a key, it's an emotion control unit. Anyway, that's pretty much it. I'm sure I'm going to think of like 1,000 random bits of trivia that I left out as soon as I leave here, and I'm not trying to come up with bits of trivia. I could probably do another one of these again at some point, I don't know. But if nothing changes, I'll be back next week. I'm going to go ahead and run through the damn radio schedule. Schedule damn radio. So 9 to 10:30, that's Sunday through Thursday, International Flavor with Sam Trapp, occasionally Matthew Von Trapp. Tuesday, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, Really Big Shoe, 2 to 4, JR. 5:30 to 7:30, Show Me History Show with Dave Maupin, Professor Jim Paisley, Bill Mulder. The topic is Mormons in the West. And 9 to International Flavor. Wednesday, 9 to 10, Damn Swag. 11 to 1, Gabby Hayes Show. Really Big Shoe. 6 to 8, Ike Skelton Radio Show. International Flavor. Thursday, it's Really Big Shoe and International Flavor. Friday, Nadine at 9 with Nadine at 9. Guest, Marshall Holbrecht, Redemption Story, Before the Last Petal Falls. 6 to 8, Eye of the Beholder with Pauly. And then we're back to Monday. 11 to 12:30, Shield Maidens in Missouri, Really Big Shoe, and this show. So that's pretty much all I got. I'll probably be back next week. Nothing changes. So thank you for listening. This is Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio.